CBS News Face the Nation in 60 seconds.
Big data may be just another overused buzzword, but storing, sharing, protecting, and recovering big data is a big deal to companies, big or small. Barracuda Networks offers powerful, affordable, yet easy-to-implement solutions for data protection and disaster recovery, email archiving, file sharing, and e-signing, all designed to protect big data and simplify IT. For an online demo or to try any of our storage solutions risk-free for 30 days, visit barracuda.com/bigdata.
Policies issued by American General Life Insurance Company, Houston, Texas. Not available in all states. For details, visit AIGDirect.com.
It takes a lot of courage to face your own death, but I'm glad I did. I'd been putting off getting life insurance, but then my best friend's husband died. I saw her struggle emotionally and financially, so I called AIG Direct. I was shocked to find a $250,000 policy for under $14 a month.
Call now for a free no-obligation quote and save up to 70%.
1-800-895-2949. That's 1-800-895-2949.
I'm Bob Schieffer, and today on Face the Nation, breaking news overnight, it appears ISIS has executed another American hostage. A new video has surfaced indicating that American aid worker Peter Kasich has been beheaded. The latest on that. And we'll talk to former Republican presidential nominee Mitt Romney, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, two key Senate Armed Services Committee members, Missouri Democrat Claire McCaskill and Utah Tea Party Republican Mike Lee, plus America's top spy, National Intelligence Director James Clapper, and a panel of analysts. 60 years of news, because this is Face the Nation. Good morning again. We are going first to London and CBS News veteran Iraq correspondent Charlie Daggett for more on this atrocity. Charlie.
Good morning, Bob. Well, the video surfaced this morning. It appears to show that same English-speaking ISIS militant seen in previous videos claiming to have beheaded Peter Kasich. Now, unlike those previous videos, this one did not show Kasich alive before the alleged beheading. The 26-year-old aid worker was captured in Syria just over a year ago while trying to deliver food. He's a former Army Ranger who'd served in Iraq, and he had set up his own agency. His family is from Indiana. They released a statement today saying they're aware of the reports of the death of their treasured son, but they're awaiting confirmation from the U.S. government. The National Security Council said this morning they're trying to confirm the authenticity of the video, but if true, the U.S. government is appalled by the brutal murder of an innocent American aid worker. The 15-minute video included a gory scene, which purported to show the beheading of more than a dozen Syrian soldiers. And unlike previous videos that usually cut away, this one showed every last detail. Bob?
Thank you so much, Charlie. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu now joins us from Jerusalem. Prime Minister, thank you for coming. Another of these hideous videos, another execution. Are we losing this war with ISIS?
No, I think you're fully engaged in it. First, let me say that we see these horrors, this additional atrocity, and the people of Israel are with you. We're with the family, with the we're with all the American people who understand the savagery that we're all up against, and we support you in this battle. We support President Obama in leading this coalition. It has to be fought, ISIS. It has to be defeated, and it can be defeated.
The last time we talked, you said that Israel was ready to help in any way possible. You did not go beyond that. Is Israel going to take a more active role in this fight against ISIS?
We're fully coordinated with the United States. We exchange all the information that needs to be exchanged, and I really don't want to go beyond that. But I will say that I think we have a global conflict here. I mean, basically, the Middle East is awash with militant Islamists, the militant Islamists led by Al-Qaeda and ISIS on the Sunni side, the militant Islamists led by Iran, and Hezbollah on the Shiite side. We want both of them to lose. The last thing we want is to have any one of them get weapons of mass destruction. Look at what ISIS is doing now with assault rifles and pickup trucks. Just imagine what Iran would do if it had nuclear weapons. So both our enemies are fighting one another, and when they are, we can both, don't strengthen either one.
President Obama says his reaching out to Iran to help in the fight against ISIS has nothing to do with Iran's nuclear program. Should the United States try to work with Iran to fight ISIS?
Iran is not your ally. Iran is not your friend. Iran is your enemy. It's not your partner. Iran is committed to the destruction of Israel, just as the P5 plus one, the United States and the world powers are negotiating with Iran a nuclear agreement. The Ayatollah Khamenei, the ruler of Iran, calls for the annihilation of Israel. He just did that 4 days ago. He specified 9 ways and reasons by which Israel should be destroyed. He's participated in rallies and chants of death to America, death to Israel. This is not a friend, neither in the battle against ISIS, nor in the effort, the great effort that should be made to deprive him the capacity to make nuclear weapons. Don't fall for Iran's ruse. They are not your friend.
There is about a week left to the deadline for the U.S.-Iran nuclear talks. Do you think the United States should agree to any concessions in order to make a deal with Iran?
I want to be clear what has to be achieved. It's not merely preventing Iran from having nuclear weapons today. It's to prevent them, Bob, from having nuclear weapons tomorrow. That means that Iran should not be left with the residual capacity to enrich uranium that you need for an atomic bomb, nor to have the long-range ballistic missiles, the ICBMs, intercontinental ballistic missiles, to launch them. Why is Khamenei developed? Why have they developed ballistic missiles? They don't need them to reach Israel. They need them to reach the United States. Now they're asking for the capacity to make, in very short order, the nuclear bombs to put on those missiles that can reach the United States. They should be deprived from having that capacity to make those weapons. And I think that's what's on the table. I think it's important to continue the sanctions. The alternative to a bad deal is not war. The alternative to a bad deal are more sanctions, tougher sanctions, that will make Iran dismantle its capacity to make nuclear bombs.
Prime Minister, I would like to hear your characterization of how you think relations are now between the United States and Israel. As you well know, an administration official told The Atlantic that you were a chicken expletive. Have those comments affected your relationship with President Obama?
Look, I'm not going to deal with anonymous sources that issue all sorts of critical statements. I think that's not appropriate. I will say this. I think the relationship between Israel and the United States is very, very strong. I mean, there's bipartisan support for Israel, which we appreciate. And not only that, I think support for Israel among the American people is at an all-time high. Because I think Americans, when they look around the Middle East and they see ISIS beheading Americans, they see the chants, death to America in Tehran, they see the fluidity, that's an understatement, the fact that one state after another is collapsing, and they see this democratic state of Israel, admittedly a beleaguered democracy, but one that stands for American values of democracy and personal liberty and free speech and an organized society and a high-tech society, people instinctively understand that Israel is America's best ally in the United States, in the Middle East, the best ally of the United States. And, you know, in Israel, we think America is our best ally, too. So there is a very, very strong bond there. And, yes, we can have disagreements between governments. That happens in the best of families. But we are one family.
Prime Minister, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Bob.
And we go now to Salt Lake City, where former Republican presidential nominee Mitt Romney is standing by. Governor, thank you so much for joining us. This is the third American now that we've seen executed. You said recently about the president's foreign policy, I'm going to quote here, "It's tempting to think he is just inept." What should we be doing differently now in this war against ISIS, and are we doing enough?
Well, first of all, what we should have done by now is have American troops staying by in Iraq. That was something that we argued for years ago. The president didn't do it. Likewise, we should have armed the moderates in Syria a long time ago so that they'd be able to keep something like ISIS from being formed. And as a result of the mistakes that have been made in the past on the president's part, we now have terrible visions being shown on TV, and of course a threat to ourselves here in the homeland. And the right course for this nation is to do whatever it takes to destroy and defeat ISIS. And of course, it's appropriate for us to provide support to the Iraqi military and intelligence. That we should have been doing a long time ago. And I think the president's wrong in saying that under no circumstances will he consider ground troops. No one wants to put our own ground troops there. But if you're going to defeat something, you don't tell the enemy exactly what you plan on doing or what you won't do. You say, we're going to defeat you regardless of the consequence.
So what you're saying, Governor, is that if it comes to it, that we may have to send American fighting forces, not just advisors, but American fighting forces on the ground back into Iraq and perhaps even into Syria?
Well, no one wants that. But when the president says we're going to destroy ISIS, then you have to recognize that that is a statement which means something. And it doesn't mean something if you say, well, we'll destroy it unless or only in the following ways. You say, instead, we're going to do whatever it takes to destroy ISIS. And that's something the president is ultimately going to have to make a decision on. I hope that we're able to see ISIS destroyed with troops from Iraq and with troops from other neighboring nations. But if that does not work, I certainly hope it does work, but if it doesn't work, we have to be open to whatever it takes to destroy ISIS. It is not acceptable for ISIS to represent the kind of threat it does to the peace of the world and to our interests as Americans.
So sending American ground troops back into Iraq is still on the table?
Well, no one wants to call it on the table, I don't think. I just don't think you take things off the table. I don't think you say that we're going to destroy ISIS. When the president says, for instance, that ISIS is a cancer, and it must be eliminated. He's right. But you don't say, well, we're only going to use the following tools in doing so. You say we're going to do whatever it takes. And hopefully we'll be able to do that with other people's troops. But if it takes our own troops, you don't take that as a source of our strength from the battlefield.
All right. Let's shift to domestic politics. Apparently a big battle coming in the Congress over immigration. The president saying he may take unilateral action that will keep millions of people in this country, illegal immigrants, from being deported. Republicans say that's waving a red flag in front of a bull. They're going to try to stop that. Some are even talking about maybe shutting down the government. What is your advice to the Republicans at this point, Governor?
Well, my advice to the Democrats at this point, and to the president in particular, is take a breath. The president said that he was not on the ballot in the election that was just held, but that his policies were. And the American people sent a very clear message to the president about his policies. They're not happy about them. The president ought to let the Republican Congress, the Republican House, and the Republican Senate come together with legislation that they put on his desk, which relates to immigration. And he can veto it or not, but let the Congress and let this election have its say, as opposed to jumping in and by doing something unilaterally and in a way which is extra constitutional, he's poking an eye of the Republican leaders in Congress, and he's making it more difficult for there to be a permanent solution to this issue. What he's proposing to do is a temporary solution, which would ultimately potentially be reversed by a Republican president. It's the wrong way to go. It doesn't help the people that are really hurt by the lack of policy in this area, and it's going to set back as opposed to bring forward the needed reforms that the American people want.
If it came to shutting down the government to prevent him from doing that, would you advise Republicans to do that, or would you want them to do something else?
Well, I think there have got to be more productive ways for us to be able to impress on the president the need to work for a permanent solution as opposed to a temporary stopgap solution. This idea of poking Republicans with a stick in the eye is not a good idea. He knows that. I had a circumstance where I fought very hard to get a majority in my state of Democrats whittled down a bit. And so I ran Republican state senators and state representatives. We worked very hard. And guess what? I lost. It didn't pick up a single seat. But instead of fighting the Democrat majority, we sat down and said, you know, we got to go about the people's business. The president has got to learn that he lost this last election round. The American people spoke loud and clear. Let those people who were elected come together with a piece of legislation on this and other topics. And then he has a chance to veto them if he doesn't like them. But the idea of violating the principles of our Constitution, which is a balance of power, checks and balances, that is something which is wrong and I think would not be to the president's benefit.
Governor, thank you so much for being with us this morning. We hope we'll see you again. We will hear next from Democrat Claire McCaskill when we come back in 1 minute. We're back now with Missouri's Democratic Senator Claire McCaskill. You just heard Governor Romney. He seems to be saying keep the option of American troops going back into Iraq on the table, at least. You're a member of the Armed Services Committee. What's your take on that?
Well, I think the president is trying to not repeat the mistakes of the past. That is, we've got to have a unified Iraq with a competent military, unless we want to tell the American people it is our job, as far as the eye can see, to in fact be the military of Iraq. So we are slowing down the advancement of ISIS. The strikes have been effective in terms of slowing their progress. We are working very hard with some of the moderate Sunnis who aren't with these guys because of their rigid ideology. They're with them because of a political failure of Maliki in Iraq. So I do think we need to give time to this strategy to work and make sure that for the first time, we have the Arab neighbors who have so much at stake in this war, that they are participating fully instead of the United States carrying the entire load.
Let me talk a little bit about what he said on immigration. He said what the Republicans have been saying up on the Hill. The president taking unilateral action on immigration is a poke in the eye, like waving a red flag in front of a bull. Are you comfortable with the president taking unilateral action?
You know, I'm not crazy about it, but let me say this. I'll tell you what a poke in the eye is. A poke in the eye is for the United States Senate almost a year and a half ago passing by a two-thirds majority a comprehensive immigration bill, with Republicans voting for it from places like Tennessee and South Carolina that just got reelected by double digits. And Speaker Boehner has refused to debate one of the most complicated and difficult problems facing our country. They won't take our bill up. All he has to do next week, if he doesn't want the president to act, is take up the Senate bill, amend it, change it, put up your own bill. Let's get back to doing our work instead of just blaming the president for everything.
Well, if you had your wish, would it be that the president not make the first move here? Give the Republicans a chance to do something first.
My wish would be that on Monday, Speaker Boehner would say, you know, we've realized this election was about change and us being functional. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to come up with a health care plan and vote on it that to replace Obamacare, which they will not do. We're going to debate immigration, another serious problem in our country that deserves debate on the floor of the House. I am tired of the politics of let's just blame the president. Let's just say everything's wrong with the president. Let's just say everything's wrong with Washington. We need a policy partner here to compromise and find consensus. I think that's what this election was about.
Let's talk about Democratic leadership. You were one of, I think, at least six Democrats who voted against Harry Reid to stay on as your leader in the Senate. Is leadership among Democrats one of the problems here?
Well, I think this was a message for the American people. Our party got walloped, and I think they're saying we need to change what we're doing, and I think change begins with leadership. It's just common sense, and it's not complicated.
It was very productive. So what do you think? What do you do from here on?
Well, I think we have to begin to find those things we can work on together. I hope the lame duck sets that tone. We're going to have to get a national security reform bill through. We've got to fund our government. I'd like us to fund our roads and bridges for longer than 6 months at a time. If we get out of this mode of just trying to make the other guys look bad and get back to working on things we can agree on, that's why as part of the kind of moderate middle in the Senate, I hope to be somebody who's driving people to the center instead of the politics of today, which has a tendency to be on the edges.
Let me ask you this. Elizabeth Warren, the fiery populist from Massachusetts, has now been part of the voted in as part of the leadership in the Senate. How do you feel about that? It's another woman in leadership. But is this going to leave the impression that the party is moving to the left when a lot of people think the only way that you can get anything done is if both parties move toward the center?
I think that the leadership team hopefully may expand even more with more moderates in it. And by the way, the same day that Elizabeth Warren was selected, so was John Tester, a flat top farmer from Montana who's about as salt of the earth as you can get and who is a moderate through and through. And so his voice is going to be in that room along with Elizabeth Warren's.
Senator, thank you so much
for
being with us. We'll be right back. We'll talk to some more Republicans in a minute.
Face the Nation after this short break.
I'm Lex Friedman. I run my own business, so I know from experience, hiring new employees can be tough. Posting your job in one place isn't enough to find quality candidates. If you want to find the perfect hire, you need to post your job on all the top job sites, and now you can. With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post your job to 50-plus job sites, including Craigslist, LinkedIn, and Twitter, all with a single click. Find candidates in any industry nationwide. Just post once and watch your qualified candidates roll in to ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. No juggling emails or calls to your office. Quickly screen candidates, rate them, and hire the right person fast. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by over 200,000 businesses. And right now, our listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/WSJ. That's ZipRecruiter.com/WSJ. One more time, to try it for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/WSJ.
For a third point of view, we turn to Republican Senator Mike Lee, conservative Republican, I should add. He's from Utah, but he joins us here in Washington this morning. We're glad to have you. Let me just ask you, Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader in the Senate, said there's no way that he's going to let the government shut down again, that he's done with that. But do you support that? Would you see circumstances where, for example, if the president takes unilateral action on immigration, that you all might threaten to shut down this government?
I think Senator McConnell's right. I think we're not heading into a government shutdown, and there are a lot of reasons for that. One of them has to do with the fact that this president has a few options in front of him. Now, he can listen to the American people who have just spoken just weeks after he said that his policies will be on the ballot. And one of those policies was, in fact, possible executive action on amnesty. He can listen to the American people, which I think would be good, or he can turn away from what the American people have said. Look, ultimately, this Congress is a Congress that's neither Republican nor Democratic. It's the American people's Congress. And Congress is going to stand up to the president, and the American people expect them to do that. 74% of those who voted in last week's election opposed the president taking this kind of unilateral executive action. And I think even if he doesn't respect elections, he at least needs to respect the rule of law. Ours is not a government of one, and he doesn't have the legislative power.
But what if he does? I mean, how far will you be willing to go to stop him?
You know, exactly what we do may depend on what he does and when he does it, how he goes about it, and what his proposed basis for doing that is. It's difficult for us to know how best we should respond when we don't know what he's going to do yet. But we're standing ready, looking at the fact that it's important for us to defend the rule of law and to make sure that the institutional prerogative of Congress, which again belongs to neither party, it just belongs to the American people, that the institutional prerogative of Congress to be the lawmaking body is respected.
A lot of people on your side of the aisle and over on the conservative part of the Republican Party, I should say the very conservative part of the Republican Party, say that there will be an effort to repeal Obamacare. Now, you know as well as I do that whatever you do on that, you don't have the votes to override a presidential veto.
That's right.
Will that be a big priority for you, or will you concede that there's no way you can defeat Obamacare?
Look, there are a lot of important policies for us to tackle in the upcoming Congress. We've got a lot of things to go after. I think that's one of them. I do think that a vote on a full repeal measure is likely, possibly on budget reconciliation. And even though we don't have the votes to override the veto, if that's what the president wants to do, the president needs to stand ready to explain to the American people why it is that a health care law that's making health care more expensive and more difficult for many people to get is still a law that he wants to impose on them.
Well, what will you try to change it?
Yes, I think there will also be a number of efforts to change it. Among other things, I think very soon we will see a vote to repeal the medical device tax in Obamacare. And I think we may see a number of other votes on other provisions as well, such as the rule moving the work week down to 30 hours, which is hurting poor and middle-class Americans disproportionately, possibly a vote on repealing the individual mandate and some other provisions.
Do you think... Your colleague Ted Cruz said that if you nominate for president next time out somebody like Bob Dole or John McCain, that you're going to elect Hillary Clinton. Does it have to be a conservative candidate next time out for you, and who would that be?
Well, look, we're a long ways away from 2016. I don't know who our nominee is going to be. For me, the important thing is the policies that the person stands for. I want somebody who will defend the basic principles that are important to so many Americans, the ability to have more government decisions made closer to home, the ability to have more decisions affecting patients made by patients themselves in consultation with their doctors and not by government bureaucrats in Washington. Those are the things that I'm worried about. I'm focused on the policies, not the personalities.
Senator, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll be right back.
Face the Nation after this short break.
Mailing your letters and packages has just gotten a lot easier, thanks to Stamps.com. With Stamps.com, you can mail and ship anything, anywhere using your computer and printer. No more trips to the post office. And it's so easy, anyone could do it. Just click, print, and mail. With Stamps.com, buy and print official U.S. postage right from your desk. Stamps.com does all the work for you. They'll even give you a digital scale that automatically calculates exact postage for any letter, any package, and any class of mail. Setup is easy, too. In minutes, you'll be printing your own postage. You'll never have to go to the post office again. Right now, get this special offer from Stamps.com when you use the promo code 60MINUTES. A no-risk trial, plus a $110 bonus offer that includes a digital scale and up to $55 in free postage. Don't wait. Go to Stamps.com. And before you do anything else, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in 60 minutes. That's Stamps.com. Promo code 60 minutes.
And welcome back to Face the Nation. Our panel today, Ruth Marcus, a columnist with the Washington Post, Jerry Seib, the Washington Bureau Chief for the Wall Street Journal, Dana Milbank, also a columnist for the Washington Post, and Jeffrey Goldberg is with the Atlantic and Bloomberg View. And Jeffrey, I'm going to start with you. You are the one that some official in the United States government told that Prime Minister Netanyahu was a chicken blank, okay?
It's
I asked him
blank,
about that.
Yes.
You heard the Prime Minister. He said relations are better than ever with the United States. Number one, if you'd care to reveal who told you that, we'd be happy to listen this morning. And also, I'd like just to get your take on U.S. and Israeli relations right now.
I'll decline your first offer.
That's very chicken-like of you.
Well, it is, but it's appropriate. On the second point, let's separate out two issues. Relations between Israel and the United States remain strong. The defense relationship, the intelligence relationship, the people-to-people, if you will. The relationship between the president of the United States and the prime minister of Israel has never been worse. We can go back to the Eisenhower period to look for a more tense
time. What's the deal?
The deal is that they're very, very different men with very, very different ideologies. Viewpoints, and this administration here believes that Netanyahu and it's a general feeling that he doesn't take risks for peace, that he doesn't do what he needs to do to solve the Middle East crisis. For his part, Netanyahu believes that this administration doesn't understand the Middle East. I mean, it's as simple as that. You know, one it leans liberal, the other leans conservative. Their dispositions are different, and so they have a very dysfunctional relationship. And it's going to be very interesting and tense to watch as they move to these Iran talks how it's going to go.
Jerry Seib, we saw this hideous video this morning, and this is the worst of the worst. This seems to me that the war on terrorism is a long way from being over. You heard Mitt Romney say we should keep on the table the idea of putting American troops back into Iraq. Is this
administration? Where do you think they are?
Well, you know, it's interesting because President Obama, talking today before he left Asia to come back home after the G20 meeting, actually left the door open a little crack, at least, for that on that question of U.S. troops on the ground. There are going to be more U.S. troops on the ground anyway. More advisors are going. But, you know, I think the key here is that this is a long struggle. You know, we're not losing the war against ISIS, but we're not winning it. And we, as a kind of an amorphous group, it's the U.S., it's Iraq, it's the Free Syrian Army, which is in real trouble up in Syria, it's the moderate Arab states, it's the Saudis. That whole collection is not winning this war, and it's going to take a while to turn it around, and it's going to be ugly along the way.
One of the Kurdish officials is saying this morning that there may be 200,000 of these ISIS people. Now, that seemed pretty high to me.
That's very high. You know, the truth is, what we don't know about ISIS exceeds what we do know. The numbers that seem to be most reasonable, somewhere in the 18,000 to 30,000 range. But again, they're drawing people, and the longer it seems that we can't stop them, the more attractive they'll be to radicals from around the world.
And, you know, one thing that's really interesting and horrifying about this terrible video is that ISIS is its own worst enemy. I think you have seen the administration, General Dempsey, last week increasingly open the door not just to more troops but to the possibility of getting increasingly involved in combat things. And we saw this in the past when ISIS engages in brutalities like this and videotapes them and puts them out for the American public to see. It riles up the American public, and it makes it easier, for better or for worse, for the president and the military to do what it needs to take to deal with ISIS.
Dana, I want to shift here just to this immigration situation. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we're heading to some kind of a showdown up on Capitol Hill. The president saying he's going to take unilateral action that would protect millions of illegal immigrants in this country from being deported. Right. Congress is saying, don't do it. You heard what both sides were saying. Where do you see this going? Do you think there's any possibility? Because some on the right are actually talking about maybe it'll come to shutting down the government again. Yeah. And maybe we'll have to do that.
Well, I love this notion that everybody's floating, that it'll poison the well, as if everybody's been drinking pure water up there and it's not already full of arsenic and PCBs already. So the well is poisoned. The president has no choice. He made this promise. He probably should have done it earlier on. And the truth is, he has an incentive to do it now because he wants to provoke a fight. If you saw the way he's come out, he's all about fighting this new Republican majority. He'd love to lure them into that shutdown, maybe even some impeachment proceedings, maybe another lawsuit to draw those distinctions. He won the shutdown fight over Obamacare, and the exit polls were lopsided in favor of legalizing the illegal immigrants. That's a fight he wants.
This may be Burr Rabbit, you know, don't throw me into that old briar patch. I mean, we remember that.
Everything about his news conference was saying, it's not my fault, no mistake here, and I'm going to go right back at it with climate change, with immigration, with minimum wage, all the things they don't want to have.
This has definitely been a let's go back at it week or few weeks since the election. Really interesting on a number of fronts. Climate change, threatening a veto on the Keystone XL pipeline, going out definitely with the Netroots on internet neutrality. Mm-hmm. And I totally agree with Dana. There is no way he can back down on fulfilling this immigration promise. I think that it's clear also from the Republican point of view that the grown-ups in the party, the leadership in the party, do not want to shut down. But to go with the bull metaphor and the flag, this is definitely waving a red flag, and the question is whether they can control the bull, because even though nobody rational wants a shutdown, it may be hard to avoid it.
Well, there's one issue, though, in which I think the president is showing he may be prepared to challenge the left, and that is free trade.
Exactly.
That's a big one, and he talked about that a lot in Asia as well, and that is not popular on the left. I think that's a real litmus test for him. Is he going to go big just on things Republicans don't like, or go big on things that define the Obama agenda, not somebody else's agenda?
Well, let me tell you something. If you needed an example that everybody's on edge up there on Capitol Hill, we got it this week during Nancy Pelosi, the House leader for Democrats, when she had a news conference. And our Nancy Cordes asked her if she, since they have lost the majority in two straight elections, if she was thinking about giving up her leadership post. And, let me just show you what she said.
I was never on the kind of Time magazine, even though it was the first woman to be. Wasn't that a curiosity that the Republicans win, Boehner's on the front of Time magazine. Mitch McConnell wins, he's on the front of Time magazine. Is there a pattern here? Now, as I said, my who I am does not depend on any of that, with all due respect to all of you. But as a woman, it's like, is there a message here? Is there something that we're missing?
May I say, as a woman?
As a woman.
Oh, please. It's not as if Nancy Pelosi, when she became the first woman Speaker of the House, did not get a ton of attention, including from yours truly. So I think, with all due respect to the former Speaker, playing the gender card here, not a great idea, but illustrative of the really tough feelings. It's not a lot of fun these days to be a Democrat in the House.
A great week for Time magazine. Didn't know that it was still
it was
like
a nice cover.
Yeah, no, didn't know that it was still the cover still mattered as much.
Well, what about this, Dana? I mean, she is a terrific fundraiser for Democrats. Is it her fault that they lost the majority two times in a row?
Well, it's not her fault per se, but, you know, the only question now is it the worst standing for House Democrats since 1946 or 1928? And when you're the leader of a party that's been brought to that point, you got to say, well, maybe you need some fresh faces. And the top three leaders are, you know, people can do very well in their 70s, but they're 74, 75.
Nice knowing you here, Dana.
And 74. Maybe they need to bring in a little fresh blood at a higher level. You've seen none of that in the House and very little of it in the Senate, a little bit with Elizabeth Warren, but no indication that I see that either side is getting ready to cut some deals or do anything. But
well, we just had Claire McCaskill here who voted against bringing Harry Reid back, and I think we know of six senators, but those votes are in secret. So there may actually have been more. But what about, Jerry, this idea of bringing Elizabeth Warren into the leadership? She's a firebrand. She's fun to interview. But she is from the left. Is that going to give the right impression to people out there
in
the Democratic Party that they're moving to the left as Republicans are moving to the right?
Well, I think she had to be taken into account. She's a force, and she represents a force. But the other thing that's happening, and you had Senator Claire McCaskill, who's from the other part of the party, the moderate part of the party, and she said, I'm part of the moderate middle in the Senate where we'd like to get some things done. The problem is that moderate middle just got wiped out, or not wiped out, at least got diluted a lot. I mean, you had Senator Pryor and Senator Hagan in North Carolina, Senator Udall. They all lost. So there's not as much in the middle left. So the left is right in saying, hey, we deserve some representation.
I was struck how quickly she mentioned Senator Tester is also coming into leadership, the flat top farmer or whatever the expression was, as almost to neutralize whatever signal Elizabeth Warren is sending, which doesn't seem like an effective messaging. Your messaging, we're still sort of the same mix of what we were.
The Democratic Party isn't really clear what it wants to be right now. It's clear that it doesn't want to be a minority party, but it's not clear how that's going to be solved.
It's not entirely clear, by the way.
And I think that it's going to need to actually take a, say, presidential election with a certain candidate to come to really have that debate fleshed out.
Harry Reid is not about to change his stripes. He's an old cop. He's an old boxer. He punched his future father-in-law. He once tried to strangle a guy who tried to offer him a bribe. He's not going to be backing down and cutting deals here, particularly as Jerry pointed out that the moderates are gone. He's going to be slugging it out for the next 2 years.
Let me just go around the table, just a quick answer from all. Who thinks Mitt Romney's going to run for president again?
We were talking about that before. I think he likes being on TV. That doesn't necessarily suggest that he's going to run for president. I'd find it hard to believe that he does.
Dana?
I think he would like to be president but not run for it, and he is not on this list of 32 possible candidates the Republican Party put out this week.
He's available to be drafted to run for president. I don't think he's going to run for president.
I'm going to go out on a little bit more of a limb. What's he doing up so early on Sunday morning? And I have to say, a lot of the points that he's making and that he made in the last campaign are looking pretty good in retrospect.
I think that if Jeb Bush does not decide to run, he will give it very serious thought. And I think that's probably where it is right now, at least from my sources. We'll be back in a moment with my interview of Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper. Thank you all very much. Who puts going to North Korea on their bucket list? America's top spy, that's who, and that's just one of the things we found out Friday when James Clapper, the Director of National Intelligence, invited us to his office to talk about his top secret trip there to bring home two American prisoners, Kenneth Bay and Matthew Miller. Why do you suppose they chose the top spy in the United States?
Well, that's a great question. For one, they wanted someone who was currently in the government, who was part of the National Security Council. And I think I kind of followed the Korean Peninsula ever since I served there as a director of intelligence for U.S. Forces Korea in the mid-80s.
Had you ever been to North Korea?
Well, this is the first time I flew over North Korea with permission. I was on a helicopter when I served in Korea in December 1985 that strayed into North Korea, obviously without their permission, and they shot at us. And fortunately, we made it back to the south. So my line is the first time I went in with permission.
Let me talk about when that United States aircraft, it was a transport plane, set down in the North Korean capital. What went through your mind? Were you apprehensive?
Yes, I was quite apprehensive because we weren't sure how this was going to play out. I personally was not completely confident that we would actually, that they would actually release our two citizens. And so, yes, it was apprehensive. And from a personal standpoint, it's kind of always been on my professional bucket list, to visit North Korea. And so I did get to do that.
Paint the scene for me. What did it look like? You said it was nighttime.
It's dark anyway in in North Korea. You know, I think, you know, it's a famous picture, overhead shot of contrasting the two parts of the peninsula at night with North Korea being quite dark and South Korea being lit up. And so that image, I think, was kind of sustained, but it was over just a very dark appearance. And so we went immediately off the plane and into a limo that took a two or three vehicle convoy that took us to the state guest house downtown Pyongyang.
And what happened then? And who greeted you?
A small greeting party that was headed by the Minister of State Security. And, of course, a translator.
And what did they talk about?
I made the point that, and I was very interested in recovering our two citizens. I think they were disappointed, frankly, that I didn't have some breakthrough.
Well, you did bring a letter from President Obama.
It generally was a pretty short letter, which basically identified me as the president's envoy and characterizing their willingness to release our two citizens as a positive gesture.
Did you take any kind of a reply back to the president?
I think the major message from them was their disappointment that there wasn't some offer, or some big, again, the term they used was breakthrough. I did take a ray of optimism from a younger interlocutor who accompanied me on the way out to the airport. And I think it illustrates the potential here for the future, because I do think there's a generational difference between the older part of the regime, by say older, my generation.
Our generation.
Yes. who are kind of stuck on their narrative. And whereas I think there is... I saw a difference generationally in this 40-something interlocutor who I think professed interest in more dialogue, asked me if I'd be willing to come back to Pyongyang, which I certainly would.
Let's go back to, so you got there, you were taken to the hotel. Was there a dinner or something like that?
Yes, I was hosted by the head of the what's called the Reconnaissance Guidance Bureau, which is their and kind of a combination intelligence and special operations force.
What was the tone of the dinner?
It was pretty terse. At least it reinforced for me something I've always think I understood about North Korea as a country that feels itself to be under siege. There's a certain institutional paranoia, and that was certainly reflected in a lot of things that he said, for example, allegations about our exercises that we conduct in the Republic of Korea. He did bring up the human rights issue at one point, although we were well into the dialogue, criticizing us for our interventionist approach our interventions, policies in their internal matters. So it was that sort of dialogue back and forth. It wasn't exactly a pleasant dinner.
When did you finally find out that you that they were going to release these people?
We spent the rest of the day waiting after for quite some time and until late afternoon, and then the MSS representative came by the state guest house, said, "You have 20 minutes to pick up your luggage. We're leaving. Check out." And then we were taken to the Corio Hotel downtown and were ushered into a room in which the amnesty granting ceremony, I guess I'd call it, was conducted.
But they hadn't, up until that point, actually told you they
not
were going to release them.
Right. And until we were moving and went to the hotel, then and then during this amnesty granting ceremony, and afterwards he turned to me and said he hoped we would have more dialogue, but not about detainees. We shook hands. I said, "Thank you." We walked out. Our two detainees changed clothes, and we went out to Sunan Airport and got on the aircraft and flew.
Do you think this has changed anything?
That's a good question. I think that remains to be seen as to where do we go from here? Will this perhaps serve as a catalyst or stimulus for more dialogue? I hope so, but I don't know.
Director, how would you rate North Korea on the scale of dangerous places in the world? Is it the most dangerous in your view?
Well, that's these days. It's hard to rank. There's lots of dangerous spots around the world. In my half century or so in intelligence, I don't know a time when we've been beset by a greater array, a more diverse array of challenges and crises than we are today. So, yes, North Korea potentially is a danger spot, but there are others.
You mentioned different danger points in the world. I wonder, could I get your take on what's happening now in Iraq and Syria, where we hear of this alliance between al-Qaeda in Syria and ISIS? Do you?
Well, I think I don't see that. We don't see that basically because of the countervailing competing objectives. And I think what you're specifically referring to is al-Nusra.
Yes.
Which is the al-Qaeda chapter franchise in Syria, and ISIS. And because of their competing objectives and who would have to be subordinate to the other, really don't see that at the strategic level. There have been tactical accommodations on the battlefield on occasion where local groups have united in the interest of a tactical objective, but broadly, I don't see those two uniting, at least yet.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I was dumbstruck when I heard the comments that are surfacing from an economist named Jonathan Gruber, who was paid $400,000 to help shape the president's health care plan. First, he allowed us how the plan passed only because of a lack of transparency, and this is a direct quote, "the stupidity of the American people." Then Friday, our Nancy Cordes found a couple of other things he said going back to 2011.
First, by mislabeling it, calling it a tax on insurance plans rather than a tax on people, and we all know it's really a tax on people who hold those insurance plans.
And there was this about Massachusetts' health care plan.
The dirty secret in Massachusetts is the feds paid for our bill. Okay, Ted Kennedy and smart people in Massachusetts have basically figured out a way to sort of rip off the feds for about $400 million a year.
I'll be honest, while I favor health insurance, I am not wild about the new plan and how it became law either. But here is my question for Mr. Gruber. If all this was as bad as you say, why did you take the money you earned as an advisor? Nor is it too late to give it back. What we have here is another example of the sorry state of American politics, where people take money for things in which they don't believe, and whether it's good for the American people is not even a question. As for the president, he may want to consider that old politician's prayer, "Lord, I can take care of my enemies, just protect me from my friends." Back in a minute. Well, that's it for today. For us, we'll see you next week right here on Face the Nation. Today's guests were Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, Senators Mike Lee and Claire McCaskill,
former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney and Director of National Intelligence James Clapper. The executive producer of Face the Nation is Mary Hager. The senior producers are Rob Hendon and Jill Jackson. This broadcast was directed by Sue Ann Stocky Wayne. Face the Nation originates from CBS News in Washington. For more Face the Nation, we're online at facethenation.com, and you can follow Face the Nation, Bob Schieffer, and CBS Radio News on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram.